welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. Continuing our exploration of the cultures of consciousness. You know, one of the good things about becoming kind of an old fart is if you did crazy, wild, exciting things in your youth, which you should do or have done, depending on where you are on the spectrum, then, you know, you can look back and you can talk about this stuff, and it's actually kind of cool and interesting, especially for people who weren't around in those days or who were little tykes. And as long as you don't pull too much of the, back in the day, it was so much better kind of crap and get all nostalgic and bitter, it can be pretty fun to look back and see what kind of connections your own more outlying experiences have with current events and such. And, you know, I have the same kind of relationship to my own experience, particularly in the early to mid-1990s, which is an incredibly rich, fascinating, wonderful period that really hasn't been kind of grokked in cultural memory. I think in many ways, for good reasons, and it's actually kind of a good thing that hasn't happened, because it means that some of the ideas and concepts that were sort of stirred up in those days really have a kind of potency even today. And one way of looking at it was there was just a certain set of people, artists, practitioners, coders, mystics, who sensed that something around this technology thing, this internet thing, but a wider than just the technology that's sitting on your desk, that something really significant was going to happen. Nobody really knew exactly what it was, and there were glints and shards of it that lots of different folks saw, you know, and some of those folks went on to really influence the dominant kinds of ideas around the internet and kind of corresponding culture. You know, example would be how this weird full-color Apple-produced zine, Mondo 2000, would really kind of flow into the early years of Wired Magazine, and then Wired Magazine would go on and become this kind of, you know, the Rolling Stone of the sort of first internet bubble. And so there is a lot of ways in which underground ideas kind of set the stage for a lot of more mainstream developments, and I was really part of that matrix of mind and still draw from it quite a bit. And one of the important nodes of that matrix for me was a review and also a bookstore called Fringeware. This bookstore was in Austin, Texas, but Fringeware Review was one of these alternative zines that had, you know, was crossing all these points of technology, esotericism, consciousness, art performance, humor. It was a very interesting kind of proto-internet culture kind of thing, except on the page. Boing Boing was another magazine at that time going on, and, you know, of course, Boing Boing kept the faith and became one of these important sites for that sort of idea of a kind of ingrained or inherent internet culture, which I think a lot of people today doesn't even necessarily make a lot of sense. It's like everything's on the internet. Well, there's no such thing as internet culture. But in the 90s, there was a sense that this was a place where something new could happen, and those streams still exist, and they, you know, manifest even in very non-technological phenomena, like, you know, Burning Man and the Maker Faire and things that are, you know, non-internet phenomenon. So it was a very rich time, and at the core of Fringeware was this very intriguing fellow named Paco Nathan, who ran the shop and who I got to know quite well, but I never really knew everything about him, and he was always kind of a shadowy figure because he had, on the one hand, he was running this weird alternative multimedia zone with all sorts of underground events and things going on, very trippy character, you know, friendly as heck with a gun in his back of his car. And when I first met him in Austin, and I was like, just a great guy. And then the more I found out about him, the more I realized he was just a very heavy, very interesting, and extremely technologically savvy fellow. And he was a writer and wrote stuff for, and still is a writer for Fringeware, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the most intriguing articles that I've ever read, one that has stayed with me for decades, that really got me thinking about all sorts of stuff in a new way, was something he wrote about corporate metabolism, which we're going to be talking about this episode. The idea, this curious thing of what corporations are. Are they alive? What does it mean to say that corporations have personhood? What is the way that the law helps corporations kind of exist? Can we think about them in a way like biological entities? Very interesting questions all raised, because it turned out that Paco had this whole, you know, other life, his quote-unquote real life, where, you know, he was, you know, educated at Stanford, an expert in machine learning, artificial intelligence, neural networks, had worked for Bell Labs, worked for Motorola, got involved with, you know, all sorts of heavy-duty corporate shenanigans. And then after the 90s and Fringeware closed shop, he went on and worked in some, you know, security firms, corporate advertising, like really moving through the belly of the beast, keeping his head open, keeping his mind open, and has recently kind of made a turn back towards writing and such. So I, you know, it's a little bit of a long introduction there, but I really wanted to set up the one of the more fascinating fellows who I've had the privilege to meet, and who very much continues to draw from that same matrix of weirdness that that attracted so many of us in the 1990s. But before we bring Paco on, our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Maja, welcome.
Hi, Eric.
How's it going?
It's going good. Man, you said all my favorite words. You said 90s, zines.
I know.
All these things that I love so much. I'm
well,
so
it's
excited.
Funny, you know, you really don't want to get nostalgic, but at the same time, it's also kind of lame, you know, not to like look and go, hey, that was really cool, or like that. Or that was a moment that could only have been then. Like, you can't, it doesn't work now in the same kind of way. But it's not just encased in amber.
I mean, I know. The first question actually that popped into my head is, I wonder if Paco made Xeroxes of his zines at his corporate job.
Yeah, we'll have to ask him. We can, in fact, we'll bring him on right now and ask him. Hey, Paco, how's it going?
Eric, hi, Maja. Thank you very much.
So, did you ever do full on like Xerox zines? I mean, when I knew Fringeware, it was already a, you know, nicely produced, stapled 8.5 by 11 publication.
Well, yeah, I did definitely did the Xerox stuff. But actually, one of the funny things about Fringeware was we always did our post production before we shot the plates to go print. We always did everything at Kinko's. So we would like do all this setup stuff in PageMaker and Photoshop and whatnot, and then we'd take the pages to Kinko's and crinkle them up and put them on a photocopier and do that about 5 or 6 times until it looked really gritty and dirty, and then we'd tear them all up and glue them back together and then send them off to the print shop. So at the time, the Bart Nagel, the art director for Mondo 2000, like, took our art director, Monty McCarter, out to drinks for like 3 hours and just was like, what Photoshop plugin do you use to do that? And we're like, Kinko's.
Yeah, it's amazing looking back at a lot of that stuff when you can see the way that the, you know, the sort of desktop computing created this sort of environment for a different kind of publication, or sort of different sense of, like, yeah, both, you know, idiosyncrasy, but also a certain kind of professional quality that then had to be you know, danced with in order to make it not seem too lame.
It was a wonderful time for publishing a lot of excellent stuff, and a lot of those folks still around too. So
you know, I thought the best way to this is, so many things we could talk about, but really is to start out maybe talking about the original idea of corporate metabolism and kind of work out that and what keeps you going with this idea, and really how your own experience working in the corporate world, working for security firms, working with artificial intelligence and, you know, machine language on all sorts of things have helped you really understand this question of, like, what corporations are, how do we think about them, how do we resist them, how do we, you know, keep them as honest as possible, and really just sort of what motivated you initially to kind of come to think about corporations in really a different way than I think most people do.
Certainly. Well, we, you know, at Fringeware, we were definitely doing a lot of critique in the media about large corporations, and there's sort of the inherent critique of mainstream media. What did it mean to be a guerrilla media outfit, and you know all the culture jamming we're involved with, things like that. So we were coming up against them a lot. And there's a lot of very strange things when you look at the largest corporations, the transnationals, that don't necessarily have a home in any particular country. Just some very strange anomalies about them. My background in studying artificial intelligence at Stanford, I try to take a look at an unknown thing and try to work and grapple a bit with the phenomenology of it and see, you know, what kind of concepts can I really use to describe it, and then can I make some sort of quantitative models? So I tried to apply that to, you know, what I was learning about corporations. At the same time, I was working, inside of a couple of really large firms, and then after that, I was at a company that, you know, was publicly traded on NASDAQ, and I was one of the execs, and I got to see this all from the inside out. And eventually I got involved. One of the companies had a large lawsuit against a transnational, and I got to see it from the side of the courtroom, what was happening that maybe doesn't get publicized as much. So, you know, these are the things that really spurred me at first.
Well, you know, staying with the courtroom thing I think is really interesting, because part of what appealed to me about your account is when you think about, well, you know, what is a corporation made of? You know, what gives it the precarious kind of life that it has? Well, once it's inertial, once it's moving through the world and connecting it, there's all sorts of things that are moving through it, people, resources, institutions, buildings, technologies, et cetera. But the thing that kind of, if to use a magical metaphor that is appropriate for your story, invokes them initially is a kind of legal arrangement. It's like a set of laws. It's language that says, okay, this is what you can do, this is what you can't do, this is how the thing is structured, this is how the responsibility is outlaid, these are sort of restrictions. You know, and the whole idea of like of limited liability is really an extraordinary event, but it most essentially occurs in law, in a sort of legal arrangement or agreement. And so the idea of like that you know the law, the courtroom would be, you know, an interesting place to understand corporations, you're like, wow, man, that's pretty dull. But at the same time, it's almost where you get to really see what the core programming, if you will, or software that's running the corporation, kind of, you get to see it open up, because it's where it gets challenged. So what did you see in the courtroom when you were watching the kind of ferocious battling that occurs largely off the, you know, the front page?
Right.
What did you start to understand about how these sort of creatures operate?
Well, the thing that struck me was I was involved in a court case. I'd actually worked for a large corporation, Motorola, and then I'd also gone to work for one of its vendors later on, and there was a machine learning project that we were on, doing some artificial neural networks for pattern recognition. And the large company wanted it, and they basically reached out and took it. You know, so it was this intellectual property issue. But when we got into federal court, as it turned out, this kind of business had been going on. There had been a fair amount of white-collar crime of a large company going after smaller firms and just tanking them and taking their lunch away. So what I saw was we got involved with a very big-time attorney, plaintiff attorney at the time, Scotty Baldwin, who passed away recently. But Scotty was, I think, number three in terms of winnings against large corporations. He was one of the main legal theorists behind the Marlboro Man case. And he was also the guy who nailed the Dow Corning asbestos lawsuit. So we've been involved in a lot of large class action stuff. And so for 2 years, I spent most of my time in federal court working with Scotty and his team, and just seeing what they did to go up against this, you know, multi-billion-dollar monster who was literally spending $100 million to try to do everything they could to attack him. And the thing is that, you know, the corporations look almost invulnerable, especially from the perspective, the street perspective of a protest. You know, these big, huge firms like Halliburton or GM or whatever, they almost seem invulnerable. But there is a class of attorneys who make their living prosecuting them, being plaintiff attorneys, and they're called corporation killers. So, you know, getting to work with those guys for a couple of years was quite enlightening.
But at the same time, you didn't just, when you came to kind of formulate your own ideas and to use writing and to use your sort of sense, your presence in kind of more underground culture to work through your ideas of the corporation, you didn't just stay on the kind of conventional, rational level of you know, corporate law and the sort of history of corporations and you know, legal battles over them. You kind of turned also to sort of to metaphor and to esoteric metaphor, to ideas of magic and enchantment. And so how did that happen? How did you move? Because you're, I mean, in a way, like you had this great, you wrote me a nice email where you sort of outlaid your whole career, and there's this wonderful paragraph where you say how in the 90s you really had, you're really moving between two very, very different worlds, and very few of the people in the underground that you were dealing with were touching that corporate world. Maybe they were working as programmers, or they were doing certain kinds of data stuff, but you were really in the heart of the beast in a way.
Yeah.
And you kind of brought those two worlds together in this vision of the corporation, not just as a sort of, you know, modern legal construct that gets, you know, that has this sort of basis in rational law, but also something a little bit more, well, enchanted is probably the word.
Well, so there's a couple of interesting touch points in history. The thing that probably piqued me initially was when you look at what it takes to start a corporation, like, you know, you walk down to the office here in California where you have to file your forms and whatnot, you've got to have a number. You've got to have a name. There's this sense of uniqueness. There's this scroll. It's almost like this magical scroll. I think of writing it in blood and baking it in the oven or something, but it's your articles of incorporation. And it's, you know, it's handled in a very hallowed way. Everything is just precise. There's usually some sort of logo, some sort of image that depicts what this corporation is. And, you know, you start putting together what are the initial assets to initiate a corporation. It starts to take on a lot of the sense of a glyph, the idea of, like Stephen Flowers wrote in Hermetic Magic about the Greek or Egyptian concept of glyph, where you are empowering an image with logos, with some words to give it a directed force. And, you know, I started playing with these, and it's like, huh, this kind of sticks. I think this is probably a good model.
It's really true, too. I mean, if you just think of corporation, you're literally taking something from the ether, using a symbol to make it into something, like, fleshy in the world, you know?
Absolutely. You know, I started digging back, and I was like, well, okay, who really started this? What were they thinking about? I started digging back further and further, like, what are the original transnational corporations? I mean, not a services, personal services corp, because every accountant has one of those, but, you know, the real transnationals that were able to, as you say, get, you know, their inertia going and sort of move without any visible support, just sort of living in language. And when you look back, that all traces back to the East India Corporation in England, which Elizabeth I signed into law. It was December 30th, 1600. So when you look back, like, who were her counselors? Who were the people?
John Dee.
Exactly. It was John Dee. And
there
actually are things that Dee wrote about incorporatus, about how could we take this alchemical concept of pulling from the ether and making something embodied. And
right. That
is incorporation.
It's like incarnation, basically.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you look at, like, if you look at maybe, like, Tilliard's view of the Elizabethan world picture, the concept of, like, the great chain of being, the thinkers of that time, the rulers and whatnot, they didn't make a separation between what we would call math and hard science and soft science and esotericism. It was all intellect. It was all combined in a whole. And this is how they thought, and this is how they practiced, and this is what they were doing when they sought to fight against the Spanish and whatnot by, you know, incorporating this company.
It's also the idea, like, you know, from that world view that, you know, which is such an interesting point, because we're really talking about the origins of modernity, and we're really talking about the origins of the world that we live in. This is just the point. This is just before science begins to split itself off from alchemy and from these other accounts of the world. It's just before you start to see, you know, parliamentary democracy and the emergence of a properly colonialist global order, which is really what's going to drive the economy of the global economy for the next,
you know, few hundred years and just, you know, get going what we're still kind of living in. So it's always good to, like, go back to the origins of a thing, and you can get a whiff, you can see an angle that gets lost later, gets lost later on. I think one of the ideas that from the occult that really helps here is the notion of an egregore. So can you explain what an egregore is?
Certainly. There's a text by Muni Sadhu. It's called The Tarot. I think it's from 1960. But there's a Hermeticism book called The Tarot that has a really fine descriptions and details of the concept of egregore. And if you trace back the history of this, this concept, the word really comes from Greek, but it symbolizes watchers. Sort of, you could think of almost angels up on some sort of towers looking over. And in practice, the notion of an egregore is what actually some of the legal theorists would cite, Tobner and others. You can think of, if you have 12 people in a room, there's a kind of zeitgeist that emerges of like a 13th person to represent the group. And I've actually read, you know, legal theories about this, how you represent organizations legally in terms of the zeitgeist notion. And it feeds directly into this, you know, again, alchemical notion of egregores. So when you talk about having a corporation with its articles, there's a structure of an egregore. There's a sort of a yod, he, vau, shin, vau, he. Different elements that represent it. And you can map this almost directly to how corporations formed in terms of having a central idea, articles of incorporation, and then a board of directors around it, and then sort of the people who are on the inside, the inside traders, you might say, of executives. And then there's this notion of an inversion, something called a Sheen inversion, which takes the message and flips it around before it goes out to the public. And so a classic example, this would be like Coke adds life. Well, actually, you know, Coke is kind of like the opposite of life, in my opinion. It kind of does things to hurt life, but everybody hears Coke adds life, and that's the message that comes out to the public, even though at the end of the day they're selling relatively toxic colored sugar water. So when you start to look at how corporations are put in practice, the notion of an egregore was the thing that fit the most closely as far as an esoteric model. And certainly for describing, you know, esoteric organizations, it's been used a lot in terms of, like, describing a magical lodge, that kind of thing. But I thought it would be pretty applicable.
Yeah, just to stay with that idea of how, I mean, one of the messages here is that the tools and the metaphors and the histories that are embedded in esotericism and in the occult, in Western esotericism, Western occult traditions, are actually very handy and helpful for understanding our secular world in many ways. So it's not about, like, oh, the true history of the world is about, you know, angels and angel magic and all the legal corporations and all that. That's just sort of, you know, froth. It's not like some conspiratorial model. It's really that these things operate on multiple levels, and just a kind of a somewhat more concrete example of that, just staying with Coca-Cola, is that, you know, using brain scans, it is very clear that different parts of the brain will light up when they think they're drinking Coca-Cola as opposed to Pepsi or some other kind of cola, even if the substance itself is the same. So basically, I give somebody two cups of the same brown syrupy toxic water, and one of them I tell them is Coca-Cola, they're going to respond to it differently, which shows that there's a cognitive overlay on the quote-unquote pure sensory experience that can be manipulated or shaped according to purely conceptual associations, which means the word Coca-Cola, it means the colors red and white, it means the Santa Claus iconography, it means Coke adds life. That whole world of advertising is in some way manifesting the kind of occult logic that we're identifying in terms of, you know, manipulating, shaping, using desire to map reality. And so even though, you know, what we're talking about, the corporation, is a more intriguing idea than just the notion that advertising is occultism, there's still something about the relevance of these occult metaphors for understanding these things today. But where did that take you? Like, where did this sort of understanding of the corporation as a kind of metaphoric egregore, how did that inform or shape you as you went on continuing to work, you know, inside corporate reality, but also resisting it and thinking about it in different ways?
Certainly. Well, you know, given my background, my background is very quantitative, a lot of statistics and predictive analytics and modeling, things like that. And that's what I'm doing actually for a living these days. But given that, my natural reaction was, well, I've got this symbol set that seems to, you know, kind of work. Let's take it for a ride, see where it goes. So I started going out and acquiring as much data as I could about transnational corporations over, you know, their 400-year history. But particularly in the past century, because a lot of strange things have happened. Kind of, they've gathered a lot of momentum recently. So I got a bunch of data and I started doing, you know, putting my data modeler hat on and seeing what can I really start to attribute to something that I would call the corporate form, the sort of the base animal, the genus. And can I put some numbers to it? And a few things really start to pop out. I mean, you see, like, for instance, one of the findings was that the major changes in corporate law over time are usually as a reaction to some sort of protest that's happened. You know, people say XYZ is bad and we've got to get rid of these corporations. And then after a period of time, the corporations start to sublate that message and basically put a watered-down version of it out themselves and own it and you know, totally annihilate the basis for protest. So we see that happening on about a 60-year period. It's somewhere between about 50 and 60 years, but more towards about 60 years, where if you come up with a strong critique against the form, the law will reflect the change about 60 years later. And that's interesting because, you know, that's beyond the time span for a given intellect. A person can't think in 60-year periods because they're not around that long. So as a consequence of that length of time, all the arguments have to be mediated. And maybe being mediated through legislatures and case law, maybe that's good, maybe some stuff gets lost, but the popular culture is entirely mediated. I mean, do you really know what, okay, so the stuff that was happening in the early 50s, 60 years ago, what were the really driving factors in the weird parts of pop culture? I mean, I wasn't around. I don't know what was going on then. And so I contend that a lot of that stuff gets lost over time. And so this is one of the quantitative findings. And so we started looking at other things. What kind of corporations are gathering steam or doing cluster analysis? Which ones are very different from the rest? And at the time, you know, AT&T and Walmart popped out. AT&T subsequently went under and got reacquired by other people. But Walmart was certainly one that was showing a lot of deformation. It wasn't really following the trends. It was a little too big and a little too at risk. And so I guess you could kind of say that I'm doing some risk analysis on the corporations to see, gosh, which ones are really ready to topple over and who can we target?
Exactly. And just to clarify that other point about the time frame, I remember that being quite striking when you laid out the specific legal cases and the dates. And it really is just that we grow up, you know, it's just like you say, people on the street assume that the corporations are kind of invulnerable because we have learned through all sorts of, you know, cultural mechanisms to think of corporations in a certain way. They're this kind, they have this sort of claim on reality. And what you're, you know, very bizarre and interesting natural history of corporations showed was that the fundamental assumptions about them would go through these little bifurcation points. They'd leapfrog, but they would do it at just the sort of rate that an individual wouldn't have to grapple with more than one of those sort of transformative moments in any given lifetime. So that the idea now, and, you know, enshrined in law, that corporations have a kind of personhood. I mean, that's totally bizarre when you first hear about it. Then you're like, well, no, that makes sense because that's, you know, then you got to get the Bill of Rights and, you know, advertising. You're like, oh, okay, that makes sense. But if you have too many of those, you're going to go, oh, that's crazy, and you're going to have people on the street, which is, of course, also what we have today, albeit in a kind of unusual In usual way. So the kinds of things that you're looking at how corporations are changing over time, what kind of logic goes in, is really, obviously incredibly important right now as people are wrestling with some of the fundamental questions of fairness and equity in our society and what are ordinary people going to do to, if not combat this, then at least find a better way of dealing with that. These are all great questions, but we're going to have to get to them in the second half of the program. We're going to take a break right now. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Dahu. We're talking with Paco Nathan, and we'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dahu. We're here with Eric Davis. We're talking with Paco Nathan about making stuff up magically, including corporations. And it was so interesting before the break, Eric was saying how people feel like they can't do anything against these corporations and what do we do? And if you look at it magically, you think about, a corporation is made by an invocation, right? You have the words, they write a spell, and they invoke it. So how do you, go against that? Well, you have to go into court with an advocate. An advocate is literally someone who vocalizes something against it, right? So you have to, kind of uninvoke it or go through the actual spell that made it and kind of, rearrange it. So you go into the kind of arena of symbols in trying to attack the corporations. And it's kind of like how people might think a demon is unconfrontation. You can't confront it, right? How do you get rid of a demon? Well, you exorcise it. You use a vocalization and call it by its name. So it seems pretty similar. And I was wondering, Paco, if you had any ideas about similarities between how to deal with corporations in that way, how does that translate to some of your artificial intelligence work and kind of how we make these technologies that are kind of becoming, incarnate, right?
Yeah.
We're kind of making incarnate technologies here. Have you seen much overlap in the way these two things are treated?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the idea of artificial intelligence is, something of science fiction. But I mean, there are definitely people who have made a living, developing these technologies. And arguably, my lab at Stanford, less than a decade later, was the same lab that Google came out of.
Mm-hmm.
So, when you look at some of the really large uses of massive amounts of data for recommenders and search engines and other types of machine learning, you start to get this sense of overlap between what's happening physically and linguistically and rhetorically with a corporation and what's happening more quantitatively with, these large internet beings like Google and whatnot. So I definitely think there's a lot of overlap there, and there's also quite a bit of theory that's been put towards, the math behind AI and machine learning, and how could that be applied? How could it be leveraged?
Well, that's crazy, too, just because a lot of the hermetic math, Kabbalistic spells, are made with numbers.
Yeah, well, the thing that another touch point of esotericism and corporate law, the thing that is kind of bubbling up in popular culture now is, again, this notion you were mentioning about corporate personhood. And it's literally a sense of evocation done within the context of a courtroom. There was a court case. A court case was 118 U.S. 394. It was back in 1886, and it was where Santa Clara County had sued against Southern Pacific Railroad for some sort of taxation issue. And it bubbled its way all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court made a decision that said, the corporation is essentially a fictitious person, and this fictitious person is evoked on behalf of the actual person who is the investor in the corporation. And then you start looking through some of the language they're using. It's like,
that's ridiculous. It's like they make a Frankenstein to represent the thing that is them or something.
Absolutely. It comes back to the notion of you know, there's something called a servitor, and in other cultures, similarly called a tulpa, I think in Tibetan, and dejin is more of like Arabic kind of culture. But yeah, it's a demon that you create and evoke. The golem, actually, in Judaism, in terms of, you know, literally the basis for Frankenstein was that you're evoking this being to act on your behalf. And the language is so similar to what's happening with corporations, and in particular the part that really gets people, like with Citizens United and whatnot, it's speaking directly to that sense of evocation. And there was a real weird twist, too, when you actually look at the actual law that was put into effect, the Bancroft-Davis story. There had been... When I first read and started looking into like evocation and corporate law, I read through 118 U.S. 394, and I read the notes and I read, you know, things that had referenced it, and there was a lot of talk about evocation and corporations as sort of this fictional being, but it wasn't actually in the court decision. And so I thought I'd made a mistake. I thought I didn't have the right document. I kept looking around, and what I've found was there was this guy who was a court reporter. His name was Bancroft Davis. He had been one of the railroad attorneys trying to litigate on behalf of corporate personhood for decades and failed. And then he became a court reporter. And when the case came up to the Supreme Court, he wrote what's called a head note, which is basically the court reporter makes a summary of the court's decision, and that all gets published together. And so the corporate personhood is only in his head note. It was never put into law by the actual Supreme Court, but yet, you know, ever since 1886, people have been using this.
Wow.
He's sort of like, you know, the penultimate, he's sort of like the very early, very successful idea of a corporate lobbyist, when you think about it, but also the esoteric nature of it is pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it created a great spin. Well, I want to talk to you more about, you know, Liber 118, which is the sort of book and sort of almost social program that you're thinking about in terms of how to mobilize all of this sort of activist energy that we're seeing these days in relationship to some of these ideas of corporate personhood. But just before I do that, I just want to take a little slice and take advantage of this opportunity talking to you, knowing that you have worked in online advertising, you know, quite recently, up until quite recently. Yeah. And you said something very interesting in your email to me that I just didn't know, which is that really some of the most talented AI people out there who are, let's say, not working for security firms or the government are working in advertising, and they're like, what we're seeing with online advertising, and all of us have experienced this, you know, things change, ads follow you around, you read articles about the loss of privacy, and it just seems weirder and weirder, and, you know, do I turn off my cookies, all this kind of stuff, it's on people's minds, but I hadn't quite understand the degree to which real data brilliance, like the cutting edge of a lot of stuff, is brought to bear on the collection and use and profiling with online information. So I would love to just give you, like, how intense is it, Paco? How bad is it, if you will?
Well, yeah, it's basically finish your PhD, get hired by an advertising firm. And it's not just advertising firms, but it is sort of the Googles of the world. An entire generation has just been totally subsumed by this. And I'm hearing rumblings now. There's a little drinking group of data scientists in the Bay Area, and you definitely hear the groundswell of, like, God, I'm never going to do advertising again. I'm going to do anything but that. But yet when you look at, you know, how everybody's making their living, they're in some sort of startup venture or another about advertising, or at least that's been the way for the past, you know, 8 years or so. Google really made the break when they changed advertising, when they changed the basis for print media and all. And, you know, the Silicon Valley VCs have scrambled to eke out every dollar they could out of copying them. So if you look, you know, at what's being invested from Sand Hill Road, it is just, you know, hundreds of advertising plays. And a lot of this is all about big data. It's about machine learning. It's about taking massive amounts of consumer data and rubbing it up against each other to come out with insights to how to target people. And, yeah, that's actually what I've done, is to build, you know, huge, you know, terabyte-scale recommender systems that would target individuals with which ads are they most likely to click, because these are the ads that people like them have already clicked. And I was appalled a couple days ago. I found out that something I'd worked on about 3 years ago actually got co-opted by the Romney campaign. So they're actually using it to target people for their political advertising in this election cycle.
Well, I'm curious on a basic level, like almost on an emotional, instinctive level. A lot of us, we start to read about profiling, and even though there are these seemingly rather flimsy walls between direct personal identification and these kinds of statistical models that, you know, target, you know, classes of individuals in order to provide information, which you can make a case is something that's good. It helps people understand. It's, we like recommenders on Amazon, et cetera, et cetera. But there's also this kind of visceral reaction a lot of people have, this kind of fear, kind of paranoia, which is, by the way, interestingly linked to that very magical worldview that we have been talking about, not in terms of ideas that, you know, these are spirits or anything like that, but it's just that the magical worldview is a worldview where there are many entities, where intelligence is distributed throughout the environment. You're not really sure what's going on. It's a somewhat paranoid place. You don't really know. You know, in a modern worldview, everything in the forest is basically dead. Yeah, the tree's alive, but it's not going to talk to you. But in that magical frame of mind, well, everything is kind of alive, and it might be observing us. It might be ready to pounce. And increasingly, our experience of the online environment is like that, where it's like, oh, my God, they're finding me. It's like, oh, my God, they're tracking my dreams. How do they know that I dreamt about how do they know that I wanted to go to Mexico? You know, and it's like there's this weird sense of a kind of you know, a sort of invasion of our desires, of the intimate details of our lives based on this profiling, which can be very effective. So I'm kind of curious for you, on a gut level, how do you feel about what's coming down the pike in terms of, you know, precisely the sort of data profiling and modeling that you were working on? Is it going to get creepier and creepier?
Yeah, no, it's creepy. I mean, okay, so on one hand, I think that certainly the 2012 election cycle, you know, I've seen a lot of top talent out of Silicon Valley get tapped for either side of the presidential race coming up. And the level of sophistication that's being deployed there, the amount of compute power, the amount of dollars that's being spent just on that data pinpointing of individuals to tip the balance in elections, it's astounding. And I don't think people are going to understand this until after the election, but I think they're going to start to grapple with, oh, my God, this is really happening to us. You know, one of the things, I don't know if you've heard about the Target case study, but there was a father of a teenage daughter who sent an angry letter to Target because they'd been sending promotions to their house to his daughter about, you know, items you'll need in your pregnancy. And as it turned out, she was pregnant. And they had targeted her individually based on some of her initial purchases when, you know, she first realized she was pregnant, some things she started buying at Target. And then they started, you know, slamming her with a mail campaign. And the father was furious and then found out and sent a rather apologetic letter to Target. But that's the world we're in right now.
Amazing. It's great. Well, you know, that thanks for that slide. I mean, it's almost like you say, well, what do you do about that? Do we just, you know, do people get try to control their data online? Do they turn off their cookies? Do they, you know,
does that mean if you start looking at a lot of porno that hookers will just start showing up at your house?
Yeah, you know, they'll send you ads from Airbnb.
Was that part of what got you to shift to a different kind of line of business? I mean, it seems like most people who have souls who do work for advertising for, you know, a variety of reasons, creatives, technologists, that there are reasons to do it. But most people get burned out and really bitter, you know, after a certain number of years. But it was part of the you know, the kind of politics of where it was going, part of your reason to kind of step away and renew your writing and your more kind of creative engagement with non corporate life.
Yeah, you know, I was literally in a meeting with some ad execs, and I was watching what was happening at you know, Occupy Oakland, and it was just, you know, how can I do this? And that really turned me in. And the thing is, I'm hearing this from a lot of my peers, too, is they want to get involved in something more physical. You know, like, for instance, there's a lot of startups I've seen lately that are doing stuff, you know, in soil science. I'm working with one of our customers. They actually use a lot of public data to target when there's likelihood of crop failures, and then, you know, put together insurance for the farmers in that targeted area. So, you know, that kind of pinpointing, I think, is really vital, and that's what our world needs. You know, we need to have water, drinkable water in a lot of the developing world, the third world, and we need to have food and air and you know, arable soil and things like that. I'd rather put all this computation resource and all this intellect towards trying to resolve, you know, the fact of some kids starving and dying, and not just some, but millions and millions and millions, as opposed to how can we target better ads for Walmart.
Yeah, well, I hope you, whatever, you know, spiritual, cognitive process, you know, worked with you will become infectious.
Through.
You know, it's hard the way our society prioritizes things, the way that it distributes resources, the way that you know, social status works. I mean, it's really it's very difficult to get to that place, even when you've, you know, had a history of working in from you know, a more outsider kind of perspective. But we got about 10 minutes left here, and I wanted to talk a little bit about Libra 118. And, you know, it sounds like what you've decided to do is as a way to, like, work through these ideas, work through actual tactical plans, possible scenarios, you know, rather than putting out a sort of call to arms, you decided to kind of approach it, at least in part, through a fiction. So tell me a little bit about what's up with Libra 118.
Certainly. Well, you know, you were mentioning about the 1990s earlier, and, you know, I definitely saw a lot of how you could tip the balance with the right narratives. And that was going on, you know, at our work at Boing Boing and Fringeware and Mondua and Early Wired and all that. I just saw these examples over and over. And even, you know, at a more general level, the whole zine movement, you know, what Samizdat really means and what it accomplished. And so it struck me that this was a kind of tool set that could be applied in the current context where we're grappling with Citizens United and Corporate Personhood and Move to Amend, which is a great organization, and also, you know, looking at what's happening with Occupy throughout the world and Anonymous. I saw what was going on socially right now, and it struck me that if you peel back the layers, definitely you know, some major forces like Burning Man and Maker Faire have kind of established a lot of tooling and a lot of cognitive framework for how people can really make a difference in the world. And they are a direct answer to the idea that transnationals will take over, because if you're making your own products, obviously the transnationals aren't taking over in that particular place. If you peel back the layers a little bit further, there's definitely, you know, Temporary Autonomous Zone by Peter Lamborn Wilson, which is sort of the theoretical basis for Burning Man and Maker Faire and things like that. So I wanted to use a narrative, and I wanted to peel back to some of the theoretical origins, like Taz, of what's going on in pop culture, and see if we could bring in some of these esoteric elements of where do corporations come from, and also where are they vulnerable, and what are the more structured ways to focus a protest. So anything that is created through evocation, you know, like an egregor, a magical egregor, also has the liability that it could be destroyed through different forms of involution. And, you know, if you read the magical tomes through the ages, there's just pages and pages of destruction rituals. But when you start to understand, you know, what that means in a court of law, there's a lot of overlap between some of those destruction rituals and involution texts and what actually happens at a plaintiff's desk in a trial, a federal trial, against a transnational. So Libra 118 is a story about a group of people who are sort of makers on steroids. It's called the Founders, and they have a set of collectives throughout the Southwest, and they've been kind of a moving force behind some of the protests that are going on at different Occupy sites. That's part of the conceit of the story. And the novel looks at a particular individual who gets pulled into this world and comes to grip with just how much freedom and power they have, but also, you know, what are their ethics, what are their motives, and what are they up fighting against?
And so I'm curious especially how you see the kinds of energies that have been released with
Burning Man and Maker Faire, you know, where people are encouraged and shown that there's a lot of opportunity for DIY in everybody's life,
right.
And that, you know, you get this sort of culture of people who are making things. And a lot of it is like goofy or fun or, you know, just wacky. A lot of it's a little bit more interesting. A lot of it, I mean, that's fun and interesting too. You know, people are building robots. People are kind of, there's this just culture of a sort of DIY maker thing that's, you know, it's really happening, which I can see really positive things about. Gives people a sense of autonomy, allows more people to tap into creativity. But I'm still feeling like there's some mismatch or disconnect between that world and maybe the world of Occupy or the world of real sort of, you know, political action, at least in some more direct sense. How are the scenarios that you're working with, which are, you know, real scenarios, even if you're playing with them in fictional form, how do you see those things converging maybe a little bit more more robustly?
Certainly. Well, you know, Scotty Baldwin, the attorney I was talking about, he had a phrase he used to use all the time that pigs grow fat, but hogs go to slaughter. And that's how he looked at you know, really large firms, is that when they get big enough to think that they rule the world and that they are not accountable, that's when they're most vulnerable. And that's when you can actually attack them with the standard mainstream tool set and put them back in their place. So, you know, coming from Scotty's worldview, if you look around right now, you know, we were just talking about machine learning and AI and whatnot and the change that it's made for big internet giants like, say, Google or Amazon or Apple, arguably, for that matter, Facebook, et cetera. Jeffrey Moore, I just went to a keynote that the guy who wrote Crossing the Chasm, it's like a required text in all business schools, just about. But Jeffrey Moore had made this presentation about how, you know, Amazon put all of retail on notice. So, you know, Sears is like a bare whisper of what it used to be, largely because of Amazon. And Google, you know, just decimated Madison Avenue in a lot of ways. And, of course, you know what Apple did to the music industry and publishing industry, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the premise of Jeffrey Moore's talk was that the large giants are pretty much on notice right now. We've seen it in retail. We've seen it in media. But the others, even manufacturing, they're on notice. And there are other things that are going to happen to displace them. So I really consider this time that we're at right now to be very foundational for how can we try to point and focus and use our magical tool set to put the right ideas out for how to, you know, manage that displacement, which the business leaders think will happen over the next decade. And one way it could play out is that there's just a lot of accumulation. There's a lot of mergers and acquisitions, so that instead of having global 1,000, you have, you know, global 20. You know, automotive certainly saw that for a while. But now we're getting electric cars. We're kind of rolling the clock back to like 1911, where, you know, there was a lot of little manufacturers for cars. So I hope I'm answering the question right. But the idea is that I think we're at this very key time where we can redirect and refocus some of the abrupt changes that are going to happen in the corporate world. And I've seen this happening over the past 10 years in the work that I do, again, with AI types of precepts and techniques, machine learning, which I think, you know, goes hand in hand with what we're talking about with corporations.
Well, and to me too, that's where it also becomes biological, right? I mean, it's almost like how the mammals took over from the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs were too big, couldn't like take care of it anymore, and they had to have all these little things scurrying around. Or how, like, when something is consuming something, it's to be a big old elephant, like it's easier to take down. So it does kind of feed into those fractal patterns that you see happen in evolution. And in biology, when something kind of consumes all this stuff to a certain level and reaches that point, like you were saying, like the hog, then the parasites or the other little organisms or the people that feed on it, they come in and they kind of like take it over.
Yeah, you know, going back to the, you know, along with that and going back to the point about kind of distributed entities out in the woods, sort of in the magical sense that you kind of deal with this paranoia, I don't subscribe to the notion of an overall omnipotence. I subscribe to more of a notion of distributed intelligences and distributed pockets of power. And I think that the narrative for transnational corporations, the narrative for constitutional law has been largely tied to the idea of omnipotence and the idea of one controlling, ruling God. I mean, if you really peel back the layers of Elizabeth, you know, I won't speak on her behalf, but certainly there was a lot of talk there. And I think that the notion that there can be a lot more distributed pockets of sovereignty is crucial. I'm a big fan of regional sovereignty. I'm a big fan of the temporary autonomous zone. I'm a big fan of, you know, local currencies for communities. I'm seeing what's going on in San Francisco with urban agriculture and, you know, just a lot of areas that maker culture, you know, as maybe if the makers when they're all in their early 20s are doing one kind of thing, but, you know, when they get to being in their 30s and 40s and 50s, it kind of branches out and permeates more through culture. So that's my hope.
Wonderful, man. Well, we're going to have to stop there. Paco, thanks so much for this very illuminating, very intriguing conversation. We could keep talking about, you know, you just opened up a whole other marvelous set of topics in terms of distributed intelligence and distributed work. But so thanks for being on the show.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Folks can also go to Lieber118.com to see more of Paco's creative work. From Maja and me to all you out there, keep your minds open.